Okay, great. Thank you. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedures Working Group call on Monday, the 7th of May, 2018. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the WebEx room. If you're only on the audio bridge, would you please let yourself be known now?
Karen Bernstein, good afternoon, evening, and morning to everyone.
Thank you, Karen. I've noted that. Anyone else? All right. Well, hearing no more names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. And with this, I'll turn it back over to Jeff Newman. Please begin.
Great. Thank you, everyone. Welcome to the weekly call. The agenda is up on the screen at the moment, so we'll go through our normal statements of interest. Just a little bit of an update as to where we are now with the initial report, and then dive right into review of a couple of the sections that are now out there. Just for those keeping score, we have now sent out to the list a number of sections, including sections 1.2, 1.4, 1.5, 1.6, 1.7, and 1.12, and hopefully in the next day or so, we will get out 1.10. So there's a lot of stuff that's out there, and only a couple sections left to go, although those sections are, as all of them, filled it with a lot of materials. So as Cheryl's saying on the chat, we are very close to releasing section 1.10, so that will be reviewed shortly. Another thing, we've started to draft the preamble, the letter, if you will, that Cheryl and I want to attach to the report describing the methodology and the application of the GNSO operating guidelines and how we've interpreted that and the methodology we're using for this report. So that should hopefully be released relatively shortly as well. Sorry, I should have asked first as I started to get into some detail, are there any updates to statements of interest that anyone would like to report? Okay, I am not seeing any. I would also like to express my own frustration, as I know you all are, on still having to use WebEx. It appears that the Adobe Connect has not yet been released for working groups, but hopefully, fingers crossed, they certainly for the next call and maybe even for calls later on this week with other working groups if you happen to be lucky enough to in those groups. So I hear someone typing in the background, so everyone could just mute their lines. I know the default on this WebEx is that the microphone is on as opposed to the microphone being off. So that's one of the drawbacks of WebEx. Okay. Okay. Nothing else on statements of interest. Okay. And sorry, I'm looking between different chats here and looking to see if any hands are raised. And for some reason, although I'm a panelist, I still have alphabetical order, so I'm not sure that the hands go to the top of the list. So if Cheryl or anyone else can help me make sure that I'm calling on the person that I know who has their hand raised, and I'll do my best to go in the appropriate order, but I can't promise you that that will be successful. Okay. Okay, so if everyone remembers the last time, we finished going over section 1.2, and now we're going to take kind of a first read through of section 1.5, which deals with the of what we call the application submission requirements, and incorporated in there are the fees, you know, the application fees, as well as a discussion of applicant support, how long the application submission period should be, and any other requirements, as well as 1.5.5, which is the terms and conditions. This was formerly in module 6, I believe, of the applicant guidebook, which was the terms and conditions that an applicant needed to agree to in order to submit its application. So I will wait if I can, someone could post the section 1.5 on the WebEx and go to page 4. For those of you following along, I actually have my own copy opened up because it's a lot easier to go through the PDF document than it is to view on WebEx, simply because you're kind of kept at a particular page on WebEx, whereas obviously your own copy, you can go back and forth. Jim, thanks. On your, you do talk about the call next week during the GDD Summit. We are still finalizing a potential rescheduling time for that, so we'll talk about that towards the end of this call. Okay. 1.5.1 on application fees, the only guidance we were given in 2007 from the GNSO was an implementation guideline B, which just really said that the fees should be designed in such a manner to make sure that there's adequate resources to cover the total cost. And it did say that application fees may differ for applicants. That was what the original guidance had said. And then how was that implemented? Well, the decision was made that the fee would be based on estimates that were, actually those estimates were made fairly early on, well before the 2012 round had started, but that the program would be self-funding, and that there were essentially three elements to determine the cost. One of those elements was to recover historical costs. The second was to, historical costs and development costs. The second element of the costs were to basically cover for the identifiable costs of evaluation and processing the applications. And then there was a third element, which was what we have all commonly referred to as the contingency fund. So the fund that is in place in case there are any disputes or in case there are any new elements that needed to undergo additional research and, you know, any unanticipated parts of the program. So what are the preliminary recommendations? Hopefully we've worded these a little bit, since this came out a little bit later than the last couple sections that we reviewed, hopefully the wording on this section under the preliminary recommendations is a little bit more conditional to indicate that we have not, these are not formal recommendations that have any sort of consensus, but rather it's the working group is considering a proposal to, and then or things of that nature, as opposed to this is our concrete recommendation. So for those that had recommended that we use that more conditional language, hopefully something like this is okay. If not, please comment and let us know if there are better ways to phrase some of this. So the first considered proposal, or the proposal that we are considering, is that it continue to be self-funding where existing ICANN activities are not used to cross-subsidize the new GTLD application evaluation, pre-delegation, and delegation processes. Now, the reason the term self-funding is being used there as opposed to another term that we've used, cost recovery, is because if you looked at, and it's actually referenced in this section, if you look at the first financial model that was put out by ICANN, I want to say in 2010 or so, this is the exact wording that they used. So we wanted to just make sure we were using similar terminology to what was used back in the 2012 round. So that's the first recommendation, or sorry, the first proposal the working group is considering. In addition, the working group generally believes that the application fee amount should continue to be based on the revenue neutral principle, though the accuracy should be improved to the greatest extent possible. Although the 2012 new GTLD applicant guidebook was silent on what should happen with any excess fees obtained through the application process, the working group is leaning towards recommending that absent the use of an application fee floor, which we describe later on, that excess fees should be refunded back to the applicants. If a deficit arises, ICANN should recover an equal amount of funds in future TLD application windows. Okay, just stopping there to see if there's any questions on that, other than, of course, what the term floor means, which we describe in number three, which we're getting to. Okay, don't see anyone with their hands raised. So number three states that the working group is also considering proposing that if in the event, yes, sorry.
Christopher, has your hand up? I just wasn't sure you saw that.
I did not. Thank you. Christopher, please.
Hi, Jeff. Good evening. Good evening, everybody. So this is Christopher Wilkinson for the record. Just two small comments on this passage. I've never been into the details of the 185,000, but two comments. First of all, the work track somewhere grumbles that ICANN could not provide them with information and documents as to how the 185,000 figure had been reached. I think you will find that from people with an accountancy background who are looking into this from the outside, they will find that rather surprising. And I think it would be recommendable to make an extra effort between the staff and the work track to get rid of that rather odd grumble in the document, because quite clearly it would be most important that ICANN should continue to be able to be to explain, if not justify, the basis on which that figure was reached. Secondly, a rather more political point. Maybe you haven't quite got to hear that yet, but on the one hand, I see that there seems to have been a surplus of 100 million, which has not yet been used. So be it. It's comfortable. But on the other hand, the document has seven pages discussing applicant support, but reports that only 2 million was ever used to promote applicant support. I think also looking at it from the outside, those two figures will seem rather odd, and if they can be massaged, corrected, or rephrased in a way which is less obviously damaging to the report of the 2012 process, it would be recommendable. Sorry to take your time, Jeff, but I hope that that proves to be useful. I shall now try and mute again.
Thank you, Christopher. And actually, those are great points. And we should drop a note in here that exactly as you said, that we were not able to get an exact breakdown of the fees that were spent and how that mapped against the $185,000. On the question about the excess fees, and this will sort of tie into Ann's question in a minute, but the you are correct that there is a, I think it's now somewhere around $80 million left in the excess application fees. This is not the auction fees. This is separate and apart from the auction fees. But because the $185,000 in theory was mapped against the potential 500 applications as opposed to the 1,900 plus applications that were received, there were a lot of fees that approximately $80 million or so of which is still left. But the problem with this group, and it's an issue that we tackled early on, was that we do not, this working group does not have the jurisdiction over making any recommendations on what to do with the excess fees left over from the last round. So whether it's a good idea to ask that some of that excess be used towards, let's say, applicant support or anything else, we were instructed quite early on that it was beyond our mandate to make any kind of recommendations with respect to the 2012 excess funds. So that's why we are not able to make any recommendations. And remember, this is very different than the auction fees, of which there's over, what, $200 million? I forget the exact amount. And there's a separate cross-community working group working on that. At this point, there's no group that I'm aware of that's working on the excess fees from the last round, although I will note that there was a proposal by the registry stakeholder group on determining or on using some of those fees towards a fee. I forgot exactly how it was worded, maybe a forbearance of fees for registry operators. But at this point, that the status of that $80 million or so remains one, beyond the jurisdiction of this group, and two, a topic of conversation that is, I think, currently taking place with the registries and the GDD staff. So, Anne, just to answer your question of how is the amount of excess determined by ICANN, ICANN does have a line item in their budget materials, which we can send around. But they are the ones that are tracking the, quote, excess fees. And it went from $92 million in last year's budget, the last fiscal year budget, which we're currently in, to the next year's fiscal, proposed fiscal budget, which starts July 1, which is in documentation that ICANN put out for comment a couple months ago. So that's where we're getting it from, Ann. We don't have an exact calculation. We just have what ICANN has represented in their budget. So Cavus has said, please repeat the amount of excess fee. So Cavus, there's two sets of fees that ICANN currently maintains. The first set of fees relates to the application fees it received from the $185,000 for each application. That amount is somewhere around $80 million. The exact amount is in the budget. I just don't have that handy. The second set of fees, which is completely separate, are the fees that were derived from contention resolution where a public auction was used. And that fund is somewhere around $200 million plus. And that is currently the subject of the cross-community working group on the auction fees, which I believe either is releasing a preliminary report shortly, or may have already. I'm not 100% confident on where they are, but that is a separate amount. So hopefully, Ann asks, does it relate to the cost of processing an application versus cost of application at 185? So Ann, the fees that were used, the methodology that was used to determine the $185,000 estimate was a guess at the amount it would take to recover historical costs and development costs as the first element. Second element being how much it would cost to actually process and evaluate an application. And the third element being a contingency fee of how much would need to be set aside in the case of litigation or some other unforeseen event. So again, that was based on an estimate of only 500 applications back in 2010. And of course, as we all know, we had nearly four times that amount. So that's why we ended up with an excess fee. Okay, thank you, Steve. We have Donna and then Caboose.
Ken sub two, yep.
Okay, Donna, Caboose, then Ken.
Do you hear me, please?
Donna Austin from Newstar. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, let's go with Donna. Let's go with Donna, then Caboose, and then Ken. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. So I forget the terminology that Christopher mentioned about grumbling that we couldn't identify how the $185,000 was arrived at. And I know that we did have some conversations in the work track about this, and I think we had differing opinions. And I am actually of the opinion that the work that was done to come up with that $185,000 fee was, we can't say it was solid because of the excess amount of fees, but I think that was more associated with the lack of understanding of how many application fees, how many applications would be submitted. I think the important thing is that there was a 30% of the application fee was for contingency. And I think that's largely the excess that was left over. And that's what ICANN is saying, that they're not prepared to release any of that excess fee until the program is complete. So in ICANN's mind, the program still continues until such time as all contracts have been executed and there are no outstanding appeal mechanisms going on. So I think we might have I can't see the language that Christopher is referring to, but my memory of the discussions within the work track is that we might have differences of opinion in that regard, because I actually tend to think that the work that was done in coming up with $185,000 wasn't as off the mark as others might have thought it is. Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks, Donna. Caboose, please.
Yes, Jeff, as far as I remember, for the auction, the amount available is $335 million, but not $200 or less. $335 million from auction, CCW auction, several times. Xavier mentioned this value. About the other access fee that you mentioned, someone says $100 million, someone says $80 million, someone says between $80 and $100, and so on and so forth. So I leave it to you. But the important issue is that never the breakdown of $185,000 was given. Never it was mentioned that based on what, because usually this should be a cost recovery issue, but not revenue creating or revenue building. So this question is not clear. If it is to have revenue, no problem. People should agree or not agree, but I think it is cost recovery approach, but I don't know whether and how and when this breakdown will be given. No breakdown was given that how they arrived at this 185,000, even for the first 500 estimation, that becomes 1,937. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. And yeah, I admit to not having paid as much attention to the amount of auction funds simply because I knew that was beyond the remit of this group. So thank you on that. And Ken, please.
Yeah, I apologize. I hope I'm coming through clearly. First of all, I'm somewhat disappointed because it sounds to me like much of the tone of this group represents some sort of a criticism of issues that are still being contended that relate to the past rounds. Number two, the $335 million number that Caboose referred to is not necessarily correct. There's well over $100 million of that that is very actively contested and is by no means a fait accompli. Number three, I think this group needs to concentrate on developing methodologies to deal with the computation of the fees in the future and developing a specific set of accounting guidelines that the group future that will allow them to pull numbers out that are truly meaningful. But we're wasting a lot of time talking about something that went on in the past and is still being currently contested. It has nothing to do with the operation of this group other than to create an awareness of the group that there are issues that could arise in the future that need to be considered as we move forward. Thank you, Jeff, for trying to keep us focused on moving forward.
Thanks, Ken. Okay, is there anyone else with their hand raised? I just want to make sure I've gotten to everybody. Jamie, please.
Yes, Jamie Baxter, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Great. I had a quick question for the group, the working group on this. As I read through this, I don't see anything specifically that calls out the use of these application fees for ICANN's own legal defense. It seems a little bit odd that applicants are paying, if in fact that's the case, that applicants are paying ICANN in order to defend itself against any issues that may rise. Was that part of the discussion? Is that something that's being considered to have been removed for the next rounds? Or I'm interested in that.
Thanks. Jamie, I don't know if, not to put people on the spot, I don't know if Krista is on the call, if she wants to respond to that.
Hi, Jeff. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you, Krista.
It's Krista for the record. So we didn't have a specific conversation on whether or not a legal offense or the related amounts should be removed from the application fees going forward. And also, if I can circle back, there wasn't there was no gripe on the information. It was exactly what I think Ken was bringing up. It was the methodology, in that we couldn't dig down into the methodology without having the breakdown into the different activities that kind of made up to the cost. And by not having that document, we couldn't really gather maybe any additional insight related to it. So it's really, there was really no gripes, and I would certainly hope that the document doesn't reflect that, but it's just more of a, we didn't have that discussion because we didn't have the document. But we'll review again to make sure that that's reflected. Thanks.
Sorry, I muted and unmuted, or unmuted and muted. So thank you, Krista. Okay, is there anyone else that's in the queue? Just do a quick scan down. Okay, let me go to the next recommendation. Oh, Donna, did you just raise your hand again? Sorry.
I did, Jeff. Donna Austin from Newstar. Jamie, just in response to your question, and this is just my opinion, that I don't recall that we discussed this in the work track explicitly, but if you think about the principle that any future program should be cost neutral to ICANN, then I think it's fair that there should be some component of the application fee is a risk or a contingency component, because it's hard to understand where certain risks might come from to ICANN as a result of the program. I think there's with new IRPs and things like that. I mean, I haven't thought it through, but if you just think about the principle that this program should be cost neutral to ICANN, then I think it makes sense to have a contingency so that ICANN can respond to any potential threat. Now, threat's the wrong word, but hopefully you understand what I mean, is that, you know, that we shouldn't be setting ICANN up to have to dig into the reserve fund, for example, to fund some legal effort that arises as a result of an application or something like that. So from my perspective, I think it is actually reasonable that be included in the considerations of an application fee. Thanks.
Jeff and Ken.
Yeah, Ken, let me just if you could make it relatively quick, because I'd like to get on, because a lot of this discussion is not necessarily on what's in the report. So if you could just make it real quick, and then I could move on.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make sure that we understand the background behind what's in the report. I'm just going to give a couple of examples. The entire process creates significant additional cost centers, one of them being, Jeff, because you've been involved in it for years, the Red Cross issue. And that was created principally because of concerns as a result of the first round. Now we have the same situation going on in Work Track 5 with Christopher, and God forbid that we think that whatever we come out with is going to be universally accepted by the GAAP. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ken. Let me just move on to the next recommendation, considered proposal, which I think I want to make sure that everyone understands what we're saying and that it's clear. So for those of you especially that were not in the work track, to make sure that this makes sense. So number three says the working group is also considering a proposal that if in the event that the estimated application fee based on the revenue neutral principle falls below some threshold amount, that the actual application fee will be set at a higher floor amount instead, which we call the application fee floor. The purpose of that floor would be to deter speculation, warehousing of TLDs, and mitigating against the use of TLDs for abusive or malicious purposes. So this ties a little bit back to a comment that I saw, I think it was Alexander made in the chat, which was if you drop the floor too low, you could end up with double, triple, quadruple the amount of applications. Some of those may be for speculative purposes, although we're speculating on that. And so it was the view of some members of the work track especially, that if it turns out that the cost of evaluating an application turns out to be really low, we would want to set a higher price floor to make sure that there's no speculation. So, for example, if we determined that the price to evaluate or the fees, sorry, that the cost to evaluate applications, including a contingency fund and also including any other elements, was $10,000, then some members of the work track thought that that was way too low, and that the fee would need to be set higher just to make sure that we deterred speculation and abuse. There's more discussion of that topic below these recommendations in the deliberations. So the discussion was to possibly set an application fee floor. Moving to the next recommendation, and I will get to comments, but I think these tie together. Number four says the application fee floor is a predetermined value that is the minimum application fee. By definition, an application fee floor will not meet the revenue principle, sorry, the revenue neutral principle, as the floor amount will be greater than the application fees, creating an excess. In the event that an application fee floor is used to determine what the fee is, then the excess fees received by ICANN should be used to benefit the following categories. And so there's a discussion of where those excess could or should be used for, at least out will be out for comment. So, of course, there may be more than that. And then number five says, to help alleviate the burden of a shortfall, a separate segregated fund should be set up that can be used to absorb any shortfalls and topped up in a later round. The amount of the contingency should be a predetermined value that is reviewed periodically to ensure its adequacies. So I know I went through three of those that are very substantive, but I thought all three, we should go through all three before we take any comments. So with that, let me look and see if there are anyone with their hand raised. So, Caboose, please. Caboose, I don't know if you're on mute.
Hello, do you hear me?
Yes, I hear you now.
Yeah, sorry. I do not properly understand the scope of this expeculation fee. If one applicant asks for one application only, why that should be have in addition to the normal to take care of the future expeculation, if that applicant would not have any other application in a certain period of time? On the other hand, if someone continuously try to make an application, I don't know what would be the maximum or floor or limit, then this expeculation should apply to that. So that should be relevant or corresponding to number of applications per a specific period. So I don't understand why everybody should be treated equally in terms of payment of that expeculation, even if he does not make any expeculation at all, and others making several expeculations. So I don't understand that. Elsewhere, the people, if they use this, it depends on number of the applications or scope and difficulty of the application to be processed. But not all of the applications are similar, taking similar time for the process and evaluated. It depends on the case. Some cases will be more difficult than others. So I don't understand this additional that you want to apply to everybody, even for those of one single application or very, very limited, versus those who have many applications, unless you put a limit and after that the price increase exponentially. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. I think so your question assumes that there's been a decision to only allow one application per applicant, or some other mechanism to deter multiple applications, which, again, all of these principles are going to be out for comment. The work track and of course the working group as a whole is just seeking information on these proposals, seeking comments on these proposals. So no decisions have been made on any of these aspects, but if it turns out that there are no limits on the number of applications, or that, as was discussed in a separate section previously, that we were not able to come up with a way to feasibly limit the applications to one per party, then the group is seeking feedback on this type of proposal. So I see Krista. Let me go over to Krista because she's one of the drafters of this. So
I want to come back.
Okay, I see Krista, then Christopher, and Cavus.
Hi, it's Krista for the record. Just to add to what you were saying there, there was the discussions in the work track were related to perhaps the correlation between the price and the demand of applications. So therefore, by putting in a floor price, chances are it was assumed or yet to be proven that the number or the volume of applications would increase. So that's where the speculation term comes from. Thank you.
Thanks, Krista. Then to Christopher, please.
Thank you, Jeff. Christopher Wilkinson for the record. This discussion gives rise to a few very short comments. First of all, the fact that the document discusses speculation and warehousing is rather revealing to the non-initiated. The implication is that in the 2012 round, there was speculation and warehousing. I didn't know that until I logged on to, for example, Donut's website. I think that was an extremely bad policy and directly in conflict with ICANN's obligations to encourage competition, fairness, and user access on a fair and non-discriminatory basis. That's another subject, but you know, the documents raise it and they don't explain it. If that happened, it has to be admitted. Secondly, the only way to stop speculation and warehousing in the future is to limit the number of applications per entity. I personally don't agree with limiting it to one. There will certainly be categories, notably in the area of IDNs, where it would be perfectly reasonable to allow for 2, 3, 4, 5, perhaps. But the idea that a company can register 100 TLDs is frankly politically scandalous and will do great damage to ICANN. And I think that has to be stopped. For the rest, we can work on it and try and find better solutions. But I'm speaking also as an active member, but not a co-chair of the co-leader of the WorkTrack 5. What I've said about multiple applications for geographic names with knobs on, excuse the West Yorkshire expression, the idea that a company could register, apply for, and have delegated multiple geographical names around the world is really politically quite shocking. And if that happens, it will do ICANN great damage and disservice. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Christopher. Again, those are some substantive comments that I think should be submitted during the comment period. I do look at some of the comments asking for a definition of speculation or warehousing. So I will take that down as a comment to see if there was one that was commonly discussed within the work track to see if we can add some language there. Krista, your hand is raised. Do you want to address another point?
I have the truth.
Okay, Cavus. Yes, Cavus.
So I'm sorry. Cavus Arasa speaking. I never suggested to limit the number to one. What I said that establish a limit X by which no speculation fee will be charged. Above that, you apply a speculation fee, either linearly or exponentially. So define a number, 5, 10, I don't know, without any additional fee or floor fee, whatever. Above that, apply that either linearly or exponentially.
Countless.
In that case, you could limit the number of or control the number of speculation. So I agree with what Christopher mentioned, but with understanding that I never proposed to limit to one. I said that establish a limit, and above that apply some additional fee in one way or other. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. Okay, is there anyone else in the queue? Okay, not seeing any. Cheryl made a comment in the chat, which I'm trying to find here.
Cheryl, here, I'll do it for you if you like. I was just reminding everybody that my chat was actually back when Caboose was making his earlier intervention, that what we're doing, remember, is looking at the accuracy and effectiveness of this document as it reflects the discussions of the work tracks. We're hearing an awful lot of excellent interventions, I admit, which really should be comments that come in. So just try and remember we're not relitigating the work track material at this stage. We are reviewing the work track material to make sure it is clear, unambiguous, and accurately reflects the deliberations. Thanks.
Yes, thanks, Cheryl. That's thank you for making that point. And I see Martin has also made a similar one in the chat. So if we move on to the next section, which talks about the specific questions that we're seeking feedback on, this is, I'm sorry, I skipped the section. Section D is what are the options under consideration along with the associated benefits and drawbacks. Since we describe most of the options up in Section C, we did not include additional ones here. But in the next section, E, on the questions, what we ask are a number of different questions, some of which people on this call have brought up. One is, are there any other mechanisms, restrictions, methodologies beyond pricing that we could use to prevent warehousing or squatting? And I'll come back to you, Caboose, in a second. Let me just go through these questions. There are questions on, you know, what to do with excess funds, considering the methodology that we're proposing to use. if we have continuous rounds, as opposed to just a round and then stopping for a period of time. And then, you know, so if we have continuous predictable rounds, you know, what are some other considerations or implications we should be thinking about, especially to make sure it's run in a revenue neutral manner? Are there any other suggestions as to how this floor, if we do adopt an application fee floor, how we might determine that floor, not what the amount should be necessarily, but what is the methodology that we should use to establish that floor? And ultimately, you know, how do we address the timely disbursement of excess funds? So as was noted previously, it's been 6 years since the application window closed, or just about 6 years, and there have been, although there's an acknowledgement that there's 80 million or so in excess fees, there's been no disbursement of those fees. ICANN staff is saying that they don't know the definition of when a round closes, and so can we, through this comment period, provide any guidance in order to define when a round starts and when a round ends for the purposes of distributing excess funds. So I see, I know Caboose wants to respond, and then in the queue, I don't know if there's, I have, okay, Ann. So first Caboose, then Ann.
Yes, Jeff, I think it would be good that once forever, it should be clarified whether we have any right to make any comment or we don't have right to make any comment because we don't want to mitigate or we don't want to intervene to whatever the work that has done. We are just listening to the explanation. So we have no right to make any comment. Can I ask myself why we are spending our time to give a rubber stamp to what the group has done or to make comment? Whenever we have any views, we will be given the statement that, yes, it's good, but make it using public comments. Why we are spending our time now here? We have full freedom to do it a public comment, but why are spending that time one meeting after the other? We had one meeting before you, and we have 1.5 hours, and so on and so forth. So why we are wasting our time? So somebody never try to kindly consider that we have also right to give our comments, and this comment should be reflected and should not be said that this is not the time to do that, do it during the public comment. This is the third time I hear the same statement from the same person. Thank you.
Okay, Caboose, just to reiterate, hopefully for the last time, the purpose of a full group review of this document is for the entire working group to make sure, number one, that the document is clear and it's understandable as to what's in this document so that anyone reading could understand it. So the comments made on defining terms and clarity, those are great comments. Number two is to make sure that we're asking all of the right questions from the public to help the working group, when we receive the comments back, to analyze the proposals we're considering or to make new proposals. And so we want to make sure we're asking all of the right questions. And three is to make sure that we've captured accurately all of the conversations that took place. So, of course, you have the right, as always, to provide substantive-based comments on whether you agree or disagree with what the work track has done, but the appropriate place and time to do that is during the comment period and, of course, afterwards during the deliberations. The reason we're doing this again is because the work tracks have been meeting for nearly a year and a half on these issues, and they have been posting on email, discussing these issues thoroughly. Work track leads have been holding multiple meetings, and so we're not trying to bring up old substantive arguments that may have already been brought up before, but rather to clarify what transpired in the work track. So I know that, Caboose, you expressed your disagreement with that, but that's the philosophy that Cheryl and I have, and the leadership, the full leadership team have embarked on for now. And so we're going to continue down this path till we get this report out for public comment. Anne, please.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. With respect to the comments you made about the second thing of are we asking the right questions, I went ahead and raised my hand because I was looking for the question, should different application fees apply to different categories of applications? And, you know, if it's in there, I'm not really seeing it, but I think it's one of the basic questions that we need to ask the public.
Yeah, thanks, Anne. That's exactly the topic of section 1.5.2, the next section. So that's what we mean by variable fees. So we will get there very shortly.
Okay, and then I'm sorry, second comment I would have is I understand exactly the methodology that we are using at this point and the fact that I'm quite sympathetic to how difficult it is to lead us as a group. I think there is a point, however, to where there's still this lingering concern. Well, really what you're seeing is we're going to put the preliminary recommendations of the work track out as the preliminary recommendations of the working group. So, you know, when we do the final consensus call, that's working group wide, right? So if we're actually trying to make this tool, you know, essentially what we're saying is you're wanting to codify and put out for this preliminary report the preliminary recommendations of the work track, not of the right? Is that what we're having to more or less explain if we follow the protocol that you guys have set out?
Thanks, Ann. Yes. Oops, I muted and unmuted, or unmuted and muted. Yes, and for a lot of these topics, it is the recommendations of the work track. There are some overall subjects which are from the working group, which we discussed, but these are, this section in particular is one where it's work track, so we should clarify that terminology in the report. And we will
okay,
do
thanks,
so.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.
Okay, checking the list for other comments. Sorry, this is slower with WebEx, and for some reason I cannot move down on the list. Okay, I see Caboose, your hand's raised. Is that an old or a new one?
Jeff, excuse me, my chat is blocked and my hand raising is blocked. Please de-block them.
Okay.
I can't have any chat.
Okay, Caboose, I will ask what's going on. While we move on to the next part, we'll see if those that are running WebEx can figure out the issue. Okay, moving on. So the deliberation section, I'm not going to go through in any kind of detail. I think most of it speaks for itself. Again, if there are any deliberations that you were involved in the work track that you feel were not captured, or if you believe, anyone in the working group believes that something's not clear, please make a comment on the email list so that we make sure that the next version that comes out is made more clear and asks all of the appropriate questions. And your hand's raised. I don't know if that's an old one. Okay, I'm going to assume, since I don't hear anything, that's an old hand. We then go on to the last section of 1.5.1. Are there any other activities in the community that may serve as a dependency or future input into this topic? And we, in this section, we refer to the other PDPs that are ongoing, as well as the any recommendations from the CCT review team that may have an impact on the fees. So we cite those specifically as dependencies that we are looking at in order to make final recommendations later on this year. Which brings us to the question that Anne has asked, and that relates to the variable fees, meaning that is there a difference, or did we discuss whether different groups of applicants would pay, or different applications would be priced differently? And for these, the only recommendations we could find from the previous round was, as we talked about in 1.5.1, a reference to say that application fees may differ for applicants. And then in implementation guideline N, talks about ICANN may put in place a fee reduction scheme for GTLD applicants from economies classified by the UN as least developed. Again, this was from 2007, so terminology may have changed since then, but we wanted to provide an actual quote of what was in that initial policy. And so how were these implemented? Essentially, there was, with the exception of those that applied in 2000, in the year 2000, for TLDs, for which the same applicant wanted to reapply for the same string in 2012, they were offered a fee which was only a percentage of what the full fee was for everybody else. And so, but essentially everyone else had the same application fee unless you qualified for the applicant support program. And if you, beyond this base fee, there was also fees, additional fees, if you wanted to, if there was string contention and you were applying as a community and wanted to receive priority as a community. So that's how we implemented this principle. And so what, to answer Ann's questions, yes, there were discussions that took place on whether there should be different charges for different types of applications. But in the, at the end of the day, what we have here is, though the working group discussed a number of different possible alternative approaches, there was no agreement on any alternatives to the 2012, it should say, round, namely that all applications should incur the same base application fee amount regardless of the type of application or the number of applications that the same applicant submits. This would not preclude the possibility of additional fees in certain circumstances, for example, objections, registry service evaluation fees, community fees, et cetera. So, and there was no, there were discussions, but there was certainly no agreements within the work track. And then for what were the options under consideration, of course, there was some, there were some that suggested that different application fees for different types of applications is only warranted if the cost incurred for processing those different types of applications are significant. So in other words, if the costs of evaluating a geographic top-level domain is the same or within a certain percentage of the costs of evaluating any other application, then the work track discussed that there really wasn't a justification for having them pay a lesser application fee. That said, if there was a significant deviation between the costs of reviewing an application for, let's say, a brand TLD versus a standard application, and that deviation was greater than something like 20%, then perhaps it is worth considering a variable pricing mechanism. So any questions on these sections, B, C, A, B, C, and D of 1.5.2, things that are not clear? Any other questions? Just scrolling through the list, not seeing any hands. There are some questions in chat. Cheryl, anything we need to go over from chat?
I'm going to copy and paste the repeated comment that Caboose was unfortunately sending just to panelists and respond to it in all participants, so he can perhaps relax on that.
Okay, thanks, Cheryl. So Section E talks about questions that we can ask to solicit feedback to help the working group overall to make recommendations. So these questions include, should there be any exceptions to the rule of everyone paying the same application fee? And if there are an exception, why or why not? Or why or why not should or shouldn't there be exceptions? if there are types of applications that result in different costs, what is the value, the amount? Now, we had used 20% for discussion purposes, but what is the amount that would justify having different fees? And some other questions in there include, if the number of applications exceed the capacity limits and projected processing costs, should there be an option to increase costs to meet the service expectations? So there are certain areas that the leadership is seeking feedback on. Okay, any questions on the questions? Christopher, please.
Hi, Christopher Wilkinson again for the record. I have several comments on this matter, but I think I'll reserve them for the next section on applicant support. But on your specific point, long before we get to increasing prices for excessive numbers of applications, we really need two fundamental parameters for the process. One is the capacity of the staff to evaluate applications. For the sake of argument, I think that's limited, and it's down to the staff, in all honesty, to say how many score, and certainly not hundreds, of applications they really think they can honestly process per week or per month. Secondly, I just recall that I have advocated on several occasions, without it being very thoroughly reported, in the that the whole process should be done by batches. And we should never be in a position where applicants can force the staff's hand to accelerate or reduce the quality of evaluation because there's such a backlog and a queue. This has to be upfront managed in terms of the capacity, the announced capacity, the funded capacity to which the CEO and the staff will adhere to process honestly and accurately the applications. And if it is X, so be it. And if the work track says it should be 2X, I'm sorry. The second point comes back again to this question about multiple applications per entity. For the sake of argument, I would accept a maximum of somewhere between 5 and 10 for applications, excluding entities who have already gone in for speculation. And that's easy to measure because since 2012, they still haven't got the TLD online. That's prima facie evidence that they asked for too many. Limit severely the number of applicants that can be accepted from individual entities, and that in and of itself will help to solve the problem. Raising prices because there are too many, that's really not going to work because some of the people who seem to have the ability to apply for many seem to have a lot of money. And at least in the United States, when the interest rates are still very, very low, they're probably doing it on borrowed money anyway. So, this business of raising prices, that would be grossly unfair to serious applicants. Just limit the number of applicants per entity severely. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Christopher. Without getting into, there's been a lot of discussion on limiting applications. So I don't want to get into that on this call, but certainly we're capturing everything that's in the chat. I do want to Catherine Ulmer does bring up a point I want to make sure that we acknowledge, which is asking a question in this section about ways in which if exceptions to the same pricing, so if we establish variable pricing or variable fees, how we would make sure that there was no gaming of that, so that we should ask questions on that topic. So we have captured that, and we will make sure. Another one for question is, how do we ensure that there's predictability for the applicants? So I think those are all really good questions, and others that I've seen in here are also really good to make sure that we are asking all the right questions. Okay, looking through the chat and looking at the time we have left, I think we can go to 1.5.3 and most likely end at 1.5.3, finish this section. So we'll have to go to 1.5.4 on the next call, because that's a pretty long topic anyway. But 1.5.3 talks about essentially the length of the application submission period. And this one is actually one that even the leadership had to go back on several times to make sure we understood a couple different terms that were used in the 2012 round and how we're using them moving forward. So the first thing to keep in mind is that when we are talking application submission period, that literally is the time in which the application system is open to accept applications. So that means not necessarily all of the time in between when the final guidebook is released and the closing of the period, but rather when the actual physical system of accepting applications is open. So if we were to do an analogy to the 2012 round, I believe it opened up on somewhere around January 12, 2012, and was supposed to end around April 12, 2012, but because of a glitch, ended up being suspended on April 11, 2012, or somewhere around there, and reopening up for a couple weeks in May. So putting that glitch aside, the application submission period was somewhere around was supposed to be somewhere around 60 days. However, 90 days. Did I say 60? January, February, March. It was 60 days. Now, the proposal here is, if you scroll down, actually, I should scroll down because we all have access on there. What we say here is for the next round of new TLD applications, applicants should have a minimum of 3 months from the time in which the application system is open until the time in which applications would become due. We want to contrast this with the communications period, which was separately defined in 2012, but often confused with the submission period. The communications period is the time in which the ICANN implements its communication plan and outreach plan in order to draw applications in. So one of the options that was considered by this work track was that the communications period, to make sure that that is at least 6 months long. We talk more about this communications period in a different section. But that we also no more than 2 months of the communications period for the next round of new GTLD should overlap with the application submission period, leaving at least 1 month following the closing of the communications period and the closing of the application submission period. Again, I know that caused some confusion within the with the work tracks and the leads, so I want to make sure that we understand that here, or that it's clearly worded. Are there any questions on C or the first option that was under consideration on D? I'm seeing a lot of chat. Unfortunately, with WebEx, it's hard to see much of the chat. So if there's anything, I'll look towards Cheryl to see if there's any reason, anything in the chat that we should go over here.
Jeff, I'm Cheryl here. Only the most recent part from Katrine and Maxine is probably worth noting to the record.
Okay, so comment from Katrine is, I'm not sure if a period of 1 month between end of communication period and end of application period is sufficient to propose. Even in Europe, many applicants made the decision at the last minute. So that's, and Maxime agrees with that. That is a substantive comment that I think is good to respond to the questions. It's not one of the recommendations. It's just something that the group had considered. So certainly in the comment period, that would be important. Seems like Anne and Jim have their hands up. So I'm going to call on Jim first because we haven't heard from him yet, and then Anne.
Remember us talking about these periods in this specificity as far as the length of them and putting some numbers around them. And I'm curious, where did the I certainly don't remember the could be shortened to as little as 60 days for the application window. So maybe I've missed that call or something, but do we – has that been noted in the transcripts and the recordings of the calls? Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. These should all be in there. Again, that's it's in section D because it was something that may have been either in a – comment that was received or in, you know, to work stream, I'm sorry, to CC2, or it may have been in the emails or it may have been during the discussion, but it, Jim, it didn't rise to the level of being a preliminary recommendation or implementation guideline. So that's why it's in section D. So certainly any comments to those would be important for the comment period. So I can't tell you where it came from. We can do some research. I think the clarity is more important now, and of course making sure that we ask the right questions about that option is put in there. Sorry, I missed, there was a chat there, so we have Anne, Christopher, and Jamie. So, Anne.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Regarding the dependencies section, does this particular item that we've been discussing have a dependencies section for application submission period?
It has a section, but there's nothing in there.
Oh, okay. I just thought perhaps the best thing to do there would be to raise the question about that's been floating around about priority rounds. In other words, the dependency there is related to maybe some work that's being done in Work Track 3. I don't know what's happening in Work Track 5 about that, but I think there is outstanding in the community a dependency question about whether there should be any priority rounds, and the reason that I think that that has to be a dependency is I don't think it's been, you know, determined within Work Track 3, and I know that coming out of the GAC, we just may see, we have already seen in some GAC comment that they ask that we, you know, give due regard to the European Commission recommendations on community applications. So that's a long path to saying that I think that the dependency that we want to state is that there's probably work track three work on priority rounds one way or the other.
Okay, thanks, Ann. Let me just ask a question on that, because this section is trying to deal with the application submission period, I guess, regardless of, at the end of the day, whether certain applications get priority over others or whether there's separate, there are separate rounds. I'm just not sure why that's a dependency. What we're trying to say is, how long should an applicant have from the time in which the system opens up until the time in which the system closes to enter their application information in? And so I'm just trying to figure out where, what the dependency would be, whether or not there are...
Just the dependency would be whether or not there's only one round, because I think that this, the way this is phrased, assumes one window. So that the question would, you know, the dependency would relate to whether there's only one window. You could have different answers to this depending upon whether you had one window or two or three. Unless you want to state that if it's, if there is only one window as the assumption underlying this, but there is a dependency there.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Ann. All right, we'll take a look in at that. I know that, sorry, I lost the list of who had, I know Jamie had his hand up and Christopher. So let me go to Jamie, then Christopher.
Yes, Jamie Baxter here. I'm wondering, in the discussion points that went on related to the application submission period, was I want to make sure that there was a thorough discussion about the nature and the logistics of community applications when suggesting a six-month communication period. For those who hear about it on day one of that six-month communication period, if they're a community organization, is 6 months enough to actually complete the requirements of a community application for all communities? I'm not suggesting in any way that it, you know, be shortened or lengthened. I just want to make sure that that's considered, because it's a very important detail of community applications, because it takes time to generate the ideas, have the community discussion, create the community policies, get the stakeholder buy-in. I mean, those sort of things take much longer than somebody who just simply has the money from an investor and can throw an application together. So I just caution that. I'm not suggesting that it be shorter or longer, but it is an important element if we're looking at the overall program, that community applications and the way they are put together do not get left behind here. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. And I think, so there is, when we get to section 1.4, which you all have copies of now, there is a more thorough discussion of the communications period. So I think that we'll make sure that, or when you read that section, if it's not covered in the deliberations, let us know. We want to make sure that that concept was captured. Okay, I know Christopher's had his hand raised, and I see Jim's hand. I think that's a new one. So Christopher, then Jim.
Thank you, Jeff. Christopher Wilkinson, for the record. I put my hand up before Anne made her excellent statement, with which I fully sympathize. First of all, there should be internal consistency between all these chapters of the report, which is not yet the case, because some of the chapters assume that there will be a single window and it will be a global free-for-all. As you've gathered, I'm not in favor of that solution. In the context of what we're looking at now, page 12, D, second bullet. Absolutely. My full support organized as a series of application windows. Precious words. That should be our fundamental policy. Then we can discuss the labeling of the application windows, their scheduling, and how each application window, depending on whether it's geographical or community or generic, each application needs more or less time to have a good submission period and a good evaluation period. That's secondary. And as I said right at the beginning, please, ICANN staff, tell us how many applications you can handle per month during the whole process. But for present purposes, absolute support for the second bullet on paragraph D on page 12. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Christopher. Let me go last to Jim, and then we'll wrap up this call. Jim?
Jeff was an old hand. Sorry about that.
Oh, great. Then I won't go to you, Jim. Thanks. great. Okay, so it looks like we've covered up to 1.5.3. Next week, we will announce, we're likely to move the time of the call next week because of the GDD summit, and so look out for that. Hopefully we'll get that out tonight or first thing in the morning tomorrow. Actually, it is first thing in the morning for some of you tomorrow. So we'll get it out shortly. So thank you, everyone, for a good call. Look for section 1.10 to come out shortly and for the announcement of when the call will be next week. Cheryl, do you have anything else to add?
Nope, all good. Thank you, everyone.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you, everyone, for joining. Today's call has been adjourned. Operator, can you please stop the recording? And everyone have a good rest of your day or night.